In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profits. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
You and DuPont, there's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite!
Nylon. And Teflon. The magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe that DuPont, the money means more than people.
There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. At the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city, Parkersburg. Lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day, right there. I took our pictures.
It's you?
That's me, without gray hair.
In the middle?
Yep. You know, I was so happy.
You're smiling.
I was. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because of, for the money, for the benefits and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you happy, sir?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant. In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose. The eye is a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong.
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, you know, 6 to 7 years. Where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
For how long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
Time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take him off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, you know, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense, you know.
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, all they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. a mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around their face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this planet will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon. All of them. He said, oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men, just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble. So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathed the fumes from them, all the samples we breathed. But we just, you know, at the time, we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for years and years, you know. And we didn't realize that our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. They had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with 3 other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love, seen them every day, cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement. None of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982, 34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
All employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than do anything, they just wrote it out. I've never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lives if they would have told us there's a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We tracked down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. You go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstruction history, and you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees? Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard, and the wife was watering the flowers, and we got our water bill in the mail, and with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look and say, oh, okay, bang, and you put it over, and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention, and I started reading through it, and then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, a gentleman named Mr. Kennedy, and I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. It was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. I mean, he was flat out lying to me. I could tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court. After a long legal battle, the judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. They've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about 17 years, and it's about killed me a couple times. I still have thyroid problems, and I have high cholesterol. And those are all associated with C8.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I'll live with until I die. And there's not any hope that that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat, and just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions.
I wanted to show you these sentences here.
But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument, it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it for money. That's the only reason they continued to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh.
He lives long enough.
It's probably up to be 150, I'm right. It's kind of, there will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview, so we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reach the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic. And you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your piece.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. It's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While the democratic discourse remains committed to arming and defending the Israeli regime, it provides Palestinians and Arabs with no meaningful change, because substantive change can only occur when international law is respected, says Ramzi Barood, editor-in-chief of Palestine Chronicle, in an article published under the heading, Leaving Aside International Law, Why Democrats Are as Dangerous as Republicans to a Just Peace in Palestine. Stay tuned for the details. Motivated by their justifiable aversion to former U.S. President Donald Trump, many analysts have rashly painted a rosy picture of how Democrats could quickly erase the bleak trajectory of the previous Republican administration. This naivety is particularly pronounced in the current spin on the Palestinian-Israeli regime discourse, which is promoting again the illusion that Democrats will succeed where their political rivals have failed. There are obvious differences in the Democrats' approach to the Palestinian-Israeli regime issue, but only in semantics and political jingoism, not the policy. This assertion can be justified if the Democratic administration's official language on Palestine and the Israeli regime is examined, and such language considered within the context of practical policies on the ground. Take recent remarks made by the new U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken during a CNN interview on February 8. Blinken's comments reminded us of the clever, albeit disingenuous, U.S. foreign policy under previous Democratic administrations. His select words may seem as a complete departure from the belligerent yet direct approach of former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Look, leaving aside the legalities of that question, meaning the illegal Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights. As a practical matter, the Golan is very important to Israel's security, Blinken said. Later in an interview, he went on to once again acknowledge, yet at the same time, sideline the question of legalities. Legal questions are something else, he said, before continuing to speak vaguely and non-committedly about the future of Syria. Juxtapose Blinken's position on the illegal Israeli regime occupation of the Golan Heights with statements made by Pompeo in November, just before the end of Trump's presidency. This is a part of Israel and central part of Israel, Pompeo claimed, as he was accompanied by the Zionist regime foreign minister Gabi Ashkenazi and speaking from the occupied Golan Heights. Pompeo's position, which is a stark violation of international law, was duly condemned by Palestinians and Arabs and criticized by various governments and international bodies. Blinken's position, however, generated little media attention and negligible, if any, serious reprimand regionally or internationally. This should not have been the case. By acknowledging the relevance of the issue of legality, then leaving it aside in favor of the seemingly more pressing question of Israeli security, Blinken simply defended the status quo, that of perpetual Zionist regime military occupation, who is also championed enthusiastically by Republicans. Succinctly, this is the Democratic doctrine on Palestine and the Israeli regime, in effect largely since the Bill Clinton era. The current administration of Joe Biden is undoubtedly following the same blueprint, which allows Washington to offer itself as a neutral party, an honest peace broker, while helping the Zionist regime achieve its strategic goals at the expense of the Palestinian and Arab people. The clear distinction between the Democratic and Republican discourses on Palestine and the Israeli regime is a relatively new phenomenon. While Republicans increasingly ignore the rights and sometimes the very existence of the Palestinians, Democrats who continue to support the Zionist regime with equal passion use more moderate, although inconsequential, language. For Democrats, international law exists but can easily be left aside to accommodate the Israeli regime's security. For them, there is such a thing as internationally recognized borders, but these borders are flexible in order to accommodate the Israeli regime's demographic fears, strategic interests, and military edge. Hence, it is easier to discredit the foreign policy agenda of Trump, Pompeo, and other Republicans, as their aggressive, dismissive language and action are unmistakably objectionable. The Democratic discourse, however, cannot be as easily censored. as it utilizes a mix of superficial language, political platitudes, and historical cliches, worded meticulously with the aim of placing the U.S. back at the driving seat of whatever political process is underway. While the democratic discourse remains committed to arming and defending the Zionist regime, it provides Palestinians and Arabs with no meaningful change, because substantive change can only occur when international law is respected. Unfortunately, according to Blinken's logic, such seemingly trivial matters should, for now, be left aside.
The debate.
Satellite images show that Israel is carrying out a significant expansion of its Dimona nuclear facility in Negev Desert. Now, this is the same location where it makes the fissile material for its nuclear arsenal. In this edition of the debate, we will be discussing Israel's policy of deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear arsenal and the support that it receives from the silence of world powers.
Satellite images of Israel's top-secret nuclear site, Dimona, shows it is undergoing a major expansion. An independent group of arms control and non-proliferation experts known as the International Panel on Fissile Material, published the images in which significant construction work is visible. The panel says a section of the complex under construction is several hundred meters from the reactor and reprocessing plant. The purpose of the construction is not known. The construction appeared to have started in early 2019 or late 2018. Israel's Dimona nuclear facility is located near the southern city of Dimona in the Negev Desert. The site, which is widely believed to be key to Israel's nuclear arms manufacturing program, was built with covert assistance from the French government in the 1960s. Though Israel has acknowledged the existence of the Dimona nuclear reactor, it has never confirmed nor denied the purpose of the facility. Reports strongly indicate that Dimona manufactures nuclear weapons. To this day, Israel has never acknowledged possessing a nuclear arsenal. Instead, it has maintained a policy of nuclear ambiguity. The Federation of American Scientists estimate that Tel Aviv has around 90 warheads made from plutonium produced in the Dimona heavy water reactor. In 2008, former President Jimmy Carter said Israel holds at least 150 nuclear weapons, the first time a U.S. president publicly acknowledged Israel's atomic arsenal.
The United States has more than 12,000 nuclear weapons, and the Soviet Union has about the same. And as you know, Great Britain and France have several hundred, and Israel has 150 or more.
Other sources, however, put the number at over 400. Tel Aviv has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency. With the support of the United States and other Western countries, the occupying regime has even refused to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. While Tel Aviv constantly calls for pressure in countries like Iran over their nuclear activities, none of Israel's nuclear facilities are subjected to IAEA inspections. Experts believe Israel's nuclear activity is the main cause of instability in the region and a proof of West's double standards vis-a-vis nukes.
Now, to continue this discussion, we're joined by peace activist and political commentator Brian Terrell, and also anti-Zionist activist and commentator Mick Napier. Now, let's begin with our first guest, Mr. Brian Terrell. Mr. Terrell, Israel built the Dimona reactor in the 1950s with extensive and clandestine help from the French, while world powers have turned a blind eye on its nuclear activities ever since. Why are world powers not so concerned about this major security threat?
Well, I think the term deliberate ambiguity, or it's been called the worst kept secret in the world, really a secret. It's a lie because it is so transparent. I think it's the blind eye is turned because Israel has been functioning as a client state of the West and in the region. And it's not just a lie, it may be the one of the most dangerous and irresponsible and destructive deceptions ever. It does put the whole area in risk. And as there's the arms race, just as after World War II, it was the United States having nuclear weapons, the first country, the only country to ever use them, that is what drove the Soviet Union to get nuclear weapons in kind. And I don't believe there is a similar race going on in the Middle East, but if there ever will be because it's driven by Israel's nuclear weapons production and not by the other nations.
Thank you very much. Let's bring in Mr. Mick Napier. Now, Mr. Napier, what do you believe to be true here? Now, in May 2008, as we saw in the package, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter confirmed that Israel had at least 150 atomic weapons in its arsenal. Why has the West failed to do something about the 60-plus-year-old nuclear elephant in the room?
I think there's two reasons. One, if we look at 1973, the war between Egypt and Israel, Israel came quite close to losing it. And we know that the communications between Israel and the USA included a threat by Israel, and it's not the first threat. They had discussed earlier detonating a nuclear weapon. They didn't do it, but they had discussed detonating a nuclear weapon in the Sinai to warn the Egyptians. But there was communications between Israel and the USA, and the USA was to a degree blackmailed because Israel threatened that it might use nuclear weapons on Cairo if it were to be losing the war, and at one stage it was. It never happened, but I think there is this aspect that shouldn't be lost sight of, that Israel does actually threaten its allies with the possibility of using a nuclear weapon if it loses a war, in order to make sure that America, Germany, and other states provide it with massive quantities of weapons to give it an edge over any coalition of Arab powers. So Israel's a dangerous possessor of nuclear weapons. By the way, there's no question that they have nuclear weapons. I was involved here in Scotland in an election campaign for an Israeli nuclear technician called Mordechai Vanunu, who was later kidnapped from Rome because he revealed to British newspapers from his experience inside the Dimona nuclear plant. He revealed that Israel was a very, very substantial possessor of nuclear weapons. So that's not in doubt. But I think Israel has shown time and time again how dangerous it is as a possessor of nuclear weapons, not only by actual threats to use the weapons, threats made to the USA and threats which made their way to the government in Cairo as well, but also because it's Israel in 1975 had Shimon Peres, who later won a Nobel Peace Prize, met with delegates from the South African military, the apartheid regime, and offered to sell nuclear weapons to the apartheid regime in South Africa. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is public domain. We have the photographs, we have the testimonies, and so on. So Israel is a possessor of nuclear weapons. That possession, that monopoly in the Middle East is protected by the USA and by the West, at the same time as they're also being intimidated by Israel. It's a very, very dangerous situation, and everybody knows the reality, despite this nonsense of deniability from Tel Aviv.
Exactly, and as you mentioned, also, in order to confirm what you just said, former CIA Director Robert Gates said during his 2006 Senate confirmation hearing for the Secretary of Defense that Iran is surrounded by, quote, powers with nuclear weapons, including the Israelis, to the West. It seems that the U.S. and Europe are deliberately turning a deaf ear to the threat coming from Israeli nuclear weapons. Mr. Terrell, what do you think is the reason for this hypocrisy?
Well, the hypocrisy, historically, it's used our Israel bombed nuclear reactors in Iraq in 1981, Syria 2007. They said that there was weapons, it was connected to some kind of weapons production. At the same time, the United States this year has announced making 80 new plutonium pits for the first time, the core of a nuclear weapon, producing more. And we are, the United States in 2015 pledged $1 trillion over 10 years for the life extension of the nuclear weapons that we possess now and development of new nuclear weapons. So there is an arms race going on. There are more nuclear weapons being built, as we see in Des Moines.
Well, we seem to have a bad connection there, Mr. Carroll. Let's bring in Mr. McNapier. Now, Mr. Napier, as Mr. Terrell also mentioned, the countries that actually assisted Israel in making these nukes include the U.S., France, Germany, Britain, Norway, and all of these have nuclear weapons themselves, and they've never insisted for Israel to join the NPT. Why?
Well, if I may correct you, they don't all have nuclear weapons. Norway doesn't, but Britain and France most certainly do. Germany doesn't. But why have they taken this attitude towards Israeli nuclear weapons? I'd have to say there is a slight contradiction. There have been feeble complaints or distancing by the European countries compared to the USA. A few years ago, Netanyahu thanked the Obama Secretary of State John Kerry for preventing the convening of a United Nations conference on a nuclear-free Middle East. Every country in the Middle East wanted the conference to take place. The UN wanted the conference to take place, including Britain and France. The only countries which opposed it were Israel and the USA. And as I say, Netanyahu thanked Kerry for preventing that awful outcome of a nuclear-free lease. So there's no question that there is an appetite across the Middle East, certainly by the people, but even by many of the states, to have a nuclear-free Middle East. Israel and the USA have prevented that wish from being fulfilled. And you have to ask the question, why? I mean, in terms of, to answer the question why, what is Israel? Israel isn't the response of Western guilt about the Holocaust. Not at all. It's a strategic alliance. I forget the Israeli Prime Minister's name, and it might come back to me, but he said famously, Israel is, and he was such a racist, Israel is a villa in the jungle, he said, meaning it's an extension of Western power into the region. And this is a tradition starting from Herzl, the founder of Zionism, even before the State of Israel is founded. They see themselves as an extension of Western civilization against the savages, the Arabs and the Iranians and others in the Middle East. Forgive my language, but this is what the villa in the jungle metaphor actually means. And therefore, the West wants Israel to be able to have a military power to repeat 1967 if it's necessary. In 1967, Israel smashed the armies of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, and made Western control of the resources of the region, the oil, safe for a generation. It headed off that threat from local people to have local control of their resources. And the nuclear question has to be seen in that context. Israel uses nuclear weapons not primarily to threaten to use them, but to tell other countries that they always have this in reserve. You don't mess with us. We are capable of overwhelming violence if anyone challenges Israeli. But, you know, essentially Israel is a projection of Western domination of the Middle East. And this is not a conspiracy theory. We can see this from before Sykes-Picot. We can see this from before Balfour, why the Zionist project was endorsed in the first place. And there's an absolute continuity. It's not, you know, sometimes there are disagreements. President Eisenhower, the Americans, kicked Israel out of Egypt in 1956 because they colluded with France and Britain, at that time the dominant powers in the Middle East, although declining. But today, Israel has changed its sponsorship
and
from
Mr.
these
Nephew.
Two fading powers to the USA, and acts as an extension of their military power.
And Mr. Nephew, I'm sorry to cut you off right there. But since you mentioned the Arab world, actually, let's not forget that the Arab world itself is now growing impatient with the situation, and Egypt in particular has threatened to walk out of the NPT unless there's some kind of progress in creating a Middle East, nuclear-free Middle East. So how long do you think the silence can last? And if you could please make it quick, because we also want to have Mr. Otero's views, and we're running out of time.
Of course. One cannot predict when do these when will this consensus end? And you're right, the Egyptian government has some sense that they shouldn't be completely subordinate to Israel. After all, they enforce the siege of Gaza together with Israel. They may see themselves as partners, but not as inferiors. So they balk, they chafe at the reality of Israel having a nuclear monopoly with which to dominate the region. So even that alliance is under serious tension. How long will it last? Who knows? But it's certainly a lie which has been promoted in Western capitals that Israel needs nuclear weapons and doesn't have them and may have them. It's the line at the moment, but it could change if there were serious, if the states in the Middle East moved together against Israel's nuclear monopoly.
Thank you very much. Let's bring back Mr. Terrell. Now, Iran's foreign minister has tagged the U.S. president, the IAEA, the British, French, and German heads of state in a tweet reminding them that Dimona is the region's only nuclear bomb factory. Would you expect any kind of reaction?
I would hope for one. I don't expect one. No, because of this deliberate ambiguity, as it's called, which brings the entire, there's no reason for Egypt to remain in the non-proliferation treaty. There's no reason for anyone, as long as a blind eye is turned to one country. This makes the entire nuclear proliferation treaty, the entire effort to disarm the world of nuclear weapons renders it incoherent. This is absolutely necessary for the fate of the world that Israel is being held responsible for the nuclear weapons that of course it has, and that it's using every day by the implied threat of just as was said, that these weapons could be used at any time, is entirely destabilizing and destructive.
So do you see any practical solution to make Israel accountable?
I think right now in the United States, it's very important for U.S. citizens to tell our government that it needs to at least go back to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that Donald Trump destroyed. That policy, that Trump's policy, was just totally. Politically, it's nonsense, and we've got nothing to lose by stepping back and going back to the status quo of the Obama years, which was bad enough, dangerous enough, but we need to lift the sanctions against Iran. We need to demand that Israel come clean on its nuclear weapons, and even then, that's just a start. That's only going to be a start to make the world safer.
Now, Mr. Napier, do you believe that there's a practical solution to make Israel accountable?
It's possible. I think it would depend, it would rely on a joint agreement, however minimal, by powers in the region to force the issue of Israel's nuclear weapons, to force it onto the public agenda. It's possible because America is pulling down its interest in the Middle East. It's beginning to focus on the possibility of a conflict with China, some sort of conflict, hopefully short of all-out war. But it's beginning to shift attention away from the Middle East. The danger there, it relies more on the Israeli surrogate, on Israel as an extension of Western power into the region, just as it did after the Vietnam War when America was being defeated and they decided that to avoid U.S. troops in the region, they would treat Israel as America's unsinkable aircraft carrier. So it's a dangerous period. But it's possible, but it would mean active diplomacy by all the powers in the region, Egypt, Iran, etc., and then we'd have to see. But it's a very dangerous situation, that's without any doubt.
Finally, Mr. Napier and Mr. Taro, both of you, if you could please wrap this up as quickly as you can. With a long history of aggression that Israel has, is it logical to allow Israel to expand its nukes? Mr. Napier.
Of course not. Israel is the only country, I think, in the world which has attacked all of its neighbors at least once and often much more than once. So it shouldn't be in possession of its so-called conventional weapons, because they are used to colonize Palestine, and there's no reason why the borders of Palestine will be the limit of Israeli ambitions. So everyone across the Middle East has an incentive to make sure that Israel does not become any stronger and is weakened, because they are a threat to the people of the region.
Thank you very much. Mr. Taro?
Well, I agree, and I think that the flow of conventional weapons from the United States and from the other Western powers needs to be addressed too. We need to have a disarmed Middle East, extreme as that sounds at this point. And the United States and Israel are the main culprits in the militarization of the region and have the biggest responsibility to do something about it.
Thank you very much, peace activist and political commentator Brian Terrell, and also anti-Zionism activist and commentator Mick Napier. Thanks to both of you for joining us on this edition of The Debate, and thanks for following the